Chapter 41. With this apology for the manier, I will now say that, he was Monsieur Simpson of a guess, but the too true. Need I say the more? He was, am I not ready speak the too much? Eugenie Lalande. This noble-spirited note I kissed a million times, and committed, no doubt, on its account, a thousand other extravagances, that have now escaped my memory. Still Talbot would not return. Alas! Could he have formed even the vaguest idea of the suffering his absence had occasioned his friend, would not his sympathizing nature have flown immediately to my relief? Still, however, he came not. I wrote. He replied. He was detained by urgent business, but would shortly return. He begged me not to be impatient, to moderate my transports, to read soothing books, to drink nothing stronger than hock, and to bring the consolations of philosophy to my aid. The fool! If he could not come himself, why, in the name of everything rational, could he not have enclosed me a letter of presentation? I wrote him again, entreating him to forward one forthwith. My letter was returned by that footman, with the following endorsement in pencil. The scoundrel had joined his master in the country. Left us yesterday, for parts unknown, did not say where or when be back, so thought best to return letter, knowing your handwriting, and as how you is always, more or less, in a hurry. Yours sincerely, Stubbs. After this, it is needless to say that I devoted to the infernal deities both master and valet. But there was little use in anger, and no consolation at all in complaint. But I had yet a resource left in my constitutional audacity. Hitherto it had served me well, and I now resolved to make it avail me to the end. Besides, after the correspondence which had passed between us, what act of mere informality could I commit, within bounds, that ought to be regarded as indecorous by Madame Lalande? Since the affair of the letter, I had been in the habit of watching her house, and thus discovered that, about twilight, it was her custom to promenade, attended only by a negro in livery, in a public square overlooked by her windows. Here, amid the luxuriant and shadowing groves, in the gray gloom of a sweet midsummer evening, I observed my opportunity and accosted her. The better to deceive the servant in attendance, I did this with the assured air of an old and familiar acquaintance. With a presence of mind truly Parisian, she took the cue at once, and, to greet me, held out the most bewitchingly little of hands. The valet at once fell into the rear, and now, with hearts full to overflowing, we discoursed long and unreservedly of our love. As Madame Lalande spoke English even less fluently than she wrote it, our conversation was necessarily in French. In this sweet tongue, so adapted to passion, I gave loose to the impetuous enthusiasm of my nature, and, with all the eloquence I could command, besought her to consent to an immediate marriage. At this impatience she smiled. She urged the old story of decorum, that bugbear which deters so many from bliss until the opportunity for bliss has forever gone by. I had most imprudently made it known among my friends, she observed, that I desired her acquaintance thus, that I did not possess it thus. Again, there was no possibility of concealing the date of our first knowledge of each other. And then she adverted, with a blush, to the extreme recency of this date. To wed immediately would be improper, would be indecorous, would be outre. All this she said with a charming air of naivety which enraptured, while it grieved and convinced me. She went even so far as to accuse me, laughingly, of rashness, of imprudence. She bade me remember that I really even know not who she was, what were her prospects, her connections, her standing in society. She begged me, but with a sigh, to reconsider my proposal, and termed my love and infatuation a will-o'-the-wisp, a fancy, or fantasy of the moment, a baseless and unstable creation rather of the imagination than of the heart. These things she uttered as the shadows of the sweet twilight gathered darkly and more darkly around us, and then, with a gentle pressure of her fairy-like hand, overthrew, in a single sweet instant, all the argumentative fabric as he had reared. I replied as best I could, as only a true lover can. I spoke at length, and perseveringly, of my devotion, of my passion, of her exceeding beauty, and of my own enthusiastic admiration. In conclusion, I dwelt, with a convincing energy, upon the perils that encompass the course of love, that course of true love, that never did run smooth, and thus deduced the manifest danger of rendering that course unnecessarily long. This latter argument seemed finally to soften the rigor of her determination. She relented. But there was yet an obstacle, she said, which she felt assured I had not properly considered. This was a delicate point for a woman to urge, especially so. In mentioning it, she saw that she must make a sacrifice of her feelings. Still, for me, every sacrifice should be made. She alluded to the topic of age. Was I fully aware of the discrepancy between us? That the age of the husband should surpass by a few years, even by 15 or 20, the age of the wife, was regarded by the world as admissible, and, indeed, as even proper, but as he had always entertained the belief that the years of the wife should never exceed in number those of the husband. A discrepancy of this unnatural kind gave rise, too frequently, alas, to a life of unhappiness. Now she was aware that my own age did not exceed 22, and I, on the contrary, perhaps, was not aware that the years of my Eugenie extended very considerably beyond that sum. About all this there was a nobility of soul, a dignity of candor which delighted, which enchanted me, which eternally riveted my chains. I could scarcely restrain the excessive transport which possessed me. My sweetest Eugenie, I cried, what is all this about which you are discoursing? Your years surpass in some measure my own. But what then? The customs of the world are so many conventional follies. To those who love as ourselves, in what respect differs a year from an hour? I am 22, you say, granted. Indeed, you may as well call me, at once, 23. Now you yourself, my dearest Eugenie, can have numbered no more than here I paused for an instant, in the expectation that Madame Lalande would interrupt me by supplying her true age. But a Frenchwoman is seldom direct, and has always, by way of answer to an embarrassing query, some little practical reply of her own. In the present instance, Eugenie, who for a few moments past had seemed to be searching for something in her bosom, at length let fall upon the grass a miniature, which I immediately picked up and presented to her. "Keep it," she said, with one of her most ravishing smiles. "Keep it for my sake, for the sake of her whom it too flatteringly represents. Besides, upon the back of the trinket you may discover, perhaps, the very information you seem to desire. It is now, to be sure, growing rather dark, but you can examine it at your leisure in the morning. In the meantime, you shall be my escort home tonight. My friends are about holding a little musical levee. I can promise you, too, some good singing. We French are not nearly so punctilious as you Americans, and I shall have no difficulty in smuggling you in the character of an old acquaintance." With this, she took my arm, and I attended her home. The mansion was quite a fine one, and, I believe, furnished in good taste. Of this latter point, however, I am scarcely qualified to judge, for it was just dark as we arrived. And in American mansions of the better sort, lights seldom, during the heat of summer, make their appearance at this, the most pleasant period of the day. In about an hour after my arrival, to be sure, a single shaded solar lamp was lit in the principal drawing room, and this apartment, I could thus see, was arranged with unusual good taste and even splendor. But two other rooms of the suite, and in which the company chiefly assembled, remained, during the whole evening, in a very agreeable shadow. This is a well-conceived custom, giving the party at least a choice of lighter shade, and one which our friends over the water could not do better than immediately adopt. The evening thus spent was unquestionably the most delicious of my life. Madame Lalande had not overrated the musical abilities of her friends, and the singing I here heard I had never heard excelled in any private circle out of Vienna. The instrumental performers were many, and of superior talents. The vocalists were chiefly ladies, and no individual sang less than well. At length, upon a peremptory call for a Dame Lalande, she arose at once, without affectation or demur, from the chaise longue upon which she had sat by my side, and, accompanied by one or two gentlemen and her female friend of the opera, repaired to the piano in the main drawing room. I would have escorted her myself, but felt that, under the circumstances of my introduction to the house, I had better remain unobserved where I was. I was thus deprived of the pleasure of seeing, although not of hearing, her sing. The impression she produced upon the company seemed electrical, but the effect upon myself was something even more. I know not how adequately to describe it. It arose in part, no doubt, from the sentiment of love with which I was imbued, but chiefly from my conviction of the extreme sensibility of the singer. It is beyond the reach of art to endow either air or recitative with more impassioned expression than was hers. Her utterance of the romance in Otello, the tone with which she gave the words, "Oh mio sasso," in the Capulet I is ringing in my memory yet. Her lower tones were absolutely miraculous. Her voice embraced three complete octaves, extending from the contralto D to the D upper soprano, and, though sufficiently powerful to have filled the San Carlos, executed, with the minutest precision, every difficulty of vocal composition, ascending and descending scales, cadences, or fiorituri. In the final of the Somnambula, she brought about a most remarkable effect at the words. Ah, non gingiumen pensiero, al contento andio son piena. Here, in imitation of Malibran, she modified the original phrase of Bellini, so as to let her voice descend to the tenor G, when, by a rapid transition, she struck the G above the treble stave, springing over an interval of two octaves. Upon rising from the piano after these miracles of vocal execution, she resumed her seat by my side. When I expressed to her, in terms of the deepest enthusiasm, my delight at her performance. Of my surprise I said nothing, and yet was I most unfeignedly surprised. For a certain feebleness, or rather a certain tremulous indecision of voice in ordinary conversation, had prepared me to anticipate that, in singing, she would not acquit herself with any remarkable ability. Our conversation was now long, earnest, uninterrupted, and totally unreserved. She made me relate many of the earlier passages of my life, and listened with breathless attention to every word of the narrative. I concealed nothing, felt that I had a right to conceal nothing from her confiding affection. Encouraged by her candor upon the delicate point of her age, I entered, with perfect frankness, not only into a detail of my many minor vices, but made full confession of those moral, and even of those physical infirmities, the disclosure of which, in demanding so much higher a degree of courage, is so much surer an evidence of love. I touched upon my college indiscretions, upon my extravagances, upon my carousals, upon my debts, upon my flirtations. I even went so far as to speak of a slightly hectic cough with which, at one time, I had been troubled, of a chronic rheumatism, of a twinge of hereditary gout, and, in conclusion, of the disagreeable and inconvenient, but hitherto carefully concealed, weakness of my eyes. Upon this latter point, said Madame Lalande, laughingly, you have been surely injudicious in coming to confession, for, without the confession, I take it for granted that no one would have accused you of the crime. By the by, she continued, have you any recollection, and here I fancied that a blush, even through the gloom of the apartment, became distinctly visible upon her cheek, have you any recollection, mon cher ami, of this little ocular assistant, which now depends from my neck? As she spoke she twirled, in her fingers, the identical double eyeglass which had so overwhelmed me with confusion at the opera. Full well, alas, do I remember it, I exclaimed, pressing passionately the delicate hand which offered the glasses for my inspection. They formed a complex and magnificent toy, richly chased and filigreed, and gleaming with jewels, which, even in the deficient light, I could not help perceiving were of high value. A bean, mon ami, she resumed with a certain empressement of manner that rather surprised me. H. Bean, mon ami, you have earnestly besought of me a favor which you have been pleased to denominate priceless. You have demanded of me my hand upon the morrow. Should I yield to your entreaties, and, I may add, to the pleadings of my own bosom, would I not be entitled to demand of you a very little boon in return? Name it. I exclaimed with an energy that had nearly drawn upon us the observation of the company, and restrained by their presence alone from throwing myself impetuously at her feet. And name it, my beloved, my Eugenie, my own. Name it. But, alas, it is already yielded ere named. You shall conquer, then, mon ami, said she, for the sake of the Eugenie whom you love, this little weakness which you have at last confessed, this weakness more moral than physical, and which, let me assure you, is so unbecoming the nobility of your real nature, so inconsistent with the candor of your usual character, and which, if permitted further control, will assuredly involve you, sooner or later, in some very disagreeable scrape. You shall conquer, for my sake, this affectation which leads you, as you yourself acknowledge, to the tacit or implied denial of your infirmity of vision. For, this infirmity you virtually deny, in refusing to employ the customary means for its relief. You will understand me to say, then, that I wish you to wear spectacles. Ah, hush, you have already consented to wear them, for my sake. You shall accept the little toy which I now hold in my hand, and which, though admirable as an aid to vision, is really of no very immense value as a gem. You perceive that, by a trifling modification thus, or thus it can be adapted to the eyes, in the form of spectacles, or worn in the waistcoat pocket as an eyeglass. It is in the former mode, however, and habitually, that you have already consented to wear it for my sake. This request, must I confess it, confused me in no little degree. But the condition with which it was coupled rendered hesitation, of course, a matter altogether out of the question. It is done, I cried, with all the enthusiasm that I could muster at the moment. It is done, it is most cheerfully agreed. I sacrifice every feeling for your sake. Tonight I wear this dear eyeglass, as an eyeglass, and upon my heart. But with the earliest dawn of that morning which gives me the pleasure of calling you wife, I will place it upon my nose, and there wear it ever afterward, in the less romantic, and less fashionable, but certainly in the more serviceable, form which you desire. Our conversation now turned upon the details of our arrangements for the morrow. Talbot, I learned from my betrothed, had just arrived in town. I was to see him at once, and procure a carriage. The soiree would scarcely break up before 2, and by this hour the vehicle was to be at the door, when, in the confusion occasioned by the departure of the company, Madam 50 could easily enter it unobserved. We were then to call at the house of a clergyman who would be in waiting, there be married, drop Talbot, and proceed on a short tour to the east, leaving the fashionable world at home, to make whatever comments upon the matter it thought best. Having planned all this, I immediately took leave, and went in search of Talbot, but, on the way, I could not refrain from stepping into a hotel, for the purpose of inspecting the miniature, and this I did by the powerful aid of the glasses. The countenance was a surpassingly Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.